TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. David Ray Griffin is the author of The New Pearl Harbor and The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, a critique of the Keene-Zelikow Report. A professor of philosophy of religion emeritus at Claremont School of Theology, Griffin's forthcoming books are 9/11 and the American Empire and Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. This is part two of a one-hour talk on the difference between the Bush administration's myth of 9/11 and reality. A compelling introductory overview over the deep flaws in the official narrative. In part one, David Ray Griffin spoke about means, motives, and the need for New Pearl Harbor. Now he takes you to the events of 9/11 in the emergency bunker under the White House. Dick Cheney is receiving reports of an aircraft approaching the Pentagon, but does not call for an evacuation.
A Pentagon spokesperson, in explaining why the Pentagon was not evacuated before it was struck, claimed that the Pentagon was simply not aware that this aircraft was coming our way. The 9/11 Commission claimed that there was no warning about an unidentified aircraft heading towards Washington until 9:36, and hence only 1 or 2 minutes before the Pentagon was struck. But this claim is contradicted by Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta's testimony about an episode that occurred in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center under the White House. In open testimony to the 9/11 Commission itself, Mineta said, "During the time that the airplane was coming into the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, 'The plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out.' And when it got down to 'The plane is 10 miles out,' the young man also said to the Vice President, 'Do the orders still stand?' And the Vice President said, 'Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?'" Mineta said that this conversation occurred at 9:25 or 9:26, hence many minutes before the Pentagon was struck. This example gives us one of the clearest examples of the fact that the Zelikow-led 9/11 Commission cannot be trusted. Having claimed that there was no knowledge that an aircraft was approaching the Pentagon until the last minute or so, it simply omitted Mineta's testimony to the contrary. Then, to rule out the possibility that the episode Mineta had reported could have occurred, it claimed that Cheney did not even arrive down at the Presidential Emergency Operations Center until almost 10 o'clock, hence about 20 minutes after the Pentagon was struck. But this claim, besides contradicting Mineta's eyewitness testimony that Cheney was already there when Mineta arrived at 9:20, also contradicts all other reports as to when Cheney had arrived there, including a report by Cheney himself. In sum, having compared the official stories about the put options, the Secret Service, and Mineta's testimony, we can reject as a myth the idea that the attacks were unexpected. However, even if the attacks had been unexpected, should they not have been prevented? This brings us to myth number 7. U.S. officials have explained why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted. Actually, there is a sense in which this claim is true. U.S. officials have explained why the U.S. military did not prevent the attacks. The problem, however, is that they have given us 3 explanations. They are all mutually contradictory, and none of them is a satisfactory explanation. I will explain. According to standard operating procedures, if an FAA flight controller notices anything that suggests a possible hijacking, the controller is to contact a superior. If the problem cannot be fixed quickly, within about a minute, the superior is to ask NORAD, the North American Aerospace Command, to send up or scramble jet fighters to find out what is going on. NORAD then issues a scramble order to the nearest Air Force base with fighters on alert. If these procedures had been carried out on the morning of 9/11, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Flight 175 would have been intercepted before they could have reached Manhattan. And American Flight 77 would have been intercepted long before it could have reached the Pentagon. Why did not such interceptions occur on 9/11? During the first few days, the public was told that no fighter jets were sent up until after the strike on the Pentagon at 9:38. However, it was also reported that signs of Flight 11's hijacking had been observed at 8:15. That would mean that although interceptions usually occur within 10 or so minutes after signs of trouble are observed, in this case, 80 or so minutes had elapsed before fighters were even airborne. This story suggested that a stand-down order had been given. Within a few days, however, a second story was put out, according to which NORAD had sent fighters up, but because notification from the FAA had been very tardy, the fighters arrived too late. On September 18th, NORAD made this second story official, embodying it in a timeline which indicated when NORAD had been notified by the FAA about each airplane and when it had scrambled fighters in response. Critics quickly showed, however, that even if the FAA notifications had come as late as NORAD's timeline indicated, NORAD's jets would have had time to make interceptions. The second story did not, therefore, remove the suspicion that a stand-down order had been given. Hoping to overcome this problem, the 9/11 Commission report provided a third account, according to which, contrary to NORAD's timeline of September 18th, the FAA did not notify NORAD about Flight 175 until after it had struck the South Tower, or about Flight 77 until after it had struck the Pentagon. But there are three big problems with this third story. One problem is the very fact that it is the third story. Normally, when a suspect in a criminal investigation keeps changing his story, we get suspicious. The military told one story right after 9/11, another story a week later, and a third through the 9/11 Commission report in 2004. But if NORAD's timeline was false, as the Commission now claims, NORAD must have been either lying or confused. But it is hard to believe that it could have been confused 1 week after 9/11, so it must have been lying. But if NORAD was lying then, why should we believe them now? Accordingly, the idea that the attacks could not have been prevented is a myth. I now turn to myth number 8. Official reports have explained why the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed. This claim suffers from the same problem as the previous one. We have had three official explanations, each of which contradicts the other, and none of which is anywhere near close to adequate. The first explanation, widely disseminated through television specials, was that the buildings collapsed because their steel columns were melted by the jet fuel-fed fires. But this explanation contained many problems, the most obvious of which is that steel does not begin to melt until about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, while open fires based on hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, cannot, even under the most ideal circumstances, rise above 1,700 degrees. A second explanation, endorsed by the 9/11 Commission report, is a pancake theory, according to which the fires, while not melting the steel, heated it up sufficiently to cause the floors weakened by the airplane strikes to break loose from the steel columns, both those in the core and those around the outside. All the floors above the strike zone hence fell down on the floor below the strike zone, causing it to break free, and this started a chain reaction so that the floors pancaked all the way down. But this explanation also suffered from many problems, the most obvious of which was that it could not explain why the buildings collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. The core of each of the twin towers consisted of 47 massive steel columns. If the floors had broken loose from them, these columns would have still been sticking up into the air 1,000 feet. The 9/11 Commission report tried to cover up this problem by claiming that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. But those massive steel columns could not be wished away. The definitive explanation was supposed to be a third one. issued by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, usually called NIST. The NIST report claimed that when the floors collapsed, they, rather than breaking free from the columns, pulled on them, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And this combination of factors resulted in global collapse. But as physicists Jim Hoffman and Stephen Jones have shown, this account is riddled with problems. One of these is that NIST's claim about the tremendously hot fires in the core is completely unsupported by the evidence or logic. A second problem is that even if this sequence of events had occurred, NIST provided no explanation as to why it would have produced global, that is, total, collapse. The NIST report asserts that column failure occurred in the core as well as the perimeter columns, but this remains a bare assertion. There is no plausible explanation of why the core columns would have broken or even buckled so as to produce global collapse. And this is only to begin to enumerate the problems in NIST's theory, all of which follow from the fact that it, like the previous two theories, is essentially a fire theory, according to which the buildings were brought down primarily by fire. By the way, when you go home tonight and light your fire in your fireplace, be sure to fireproof your steel, or the grate may collapse. But these fire theories face several formidable problems. First, the fires in these three buildings were not very hot, very big, or very long-lasting, compared with fires in some steel frame high-rises that did not collapse. A 1991 fire in Philadelphia burned 18 hours, and a 2004 fire in Caracas burned 17 hours without causing even a partial collapse. By contrast, the fires in the North and South Towers burned only 102 and 56 minutes, respectively, before they collapsed. And neither fire, unlike the Philadelphia and Caracas fires, were hot enough to break windows. Second, total collapses of steel frame high-rise buildings have never, either before or after 9/11, been brought about by fire alone or fire plus externally caused structural damage. The collapse of Building 7 has been recognized as especially difficult to explain. It was not hit by a plane, so the explanation has to rely solely on fire. And yet, because there was no jet fuel to get a big fire started, this building had fires on only two or three floors, according to several witnesses and all photographic evidence. FEMA admitted that the best theory it could come up with for this collapse had only a low probability of occurrence. The 9/11 Commission report implicitly admitted that it could not explain the collapse of this building by not even mentioning it. In any case, a third problem with the official account of the collapses of these three buildings is that all prior and subsequent collapses, total collapses of steel frame high-rises, have been caused by explosives in the procedure known as controlled demolition. This problem is made even more severe by the fact that the collapses of these three buildings manifested many features of the most difficult type of controlled demolition known as implosion. I will mention seven such features. First, the collapses began suddenly. Steel, if weakened by fire, would gradually begin to sag. But as one can see from the videos available on the web, all three buildings are completely motionless up to the moment they begin to collapse. Second, if these huge buildings had toppled over, they would have caused enormous death and destruction in Lower Manhattan. But they came straight down. This straight down collapse is the whole point of controlled implosion, which only a few companies in the world are qualified to pull off. Third, these buildings collapsed at virtually free fall speed, which means that the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, were offering virtually no resistance. Fourth, as mentioned earlier, these collapses were total collapses, resulting in piles of rubble only a few stories high. This means that the enormous steel columns in the core of each building had to be broken into rather short segments, which is what explosives do. Fifth, great quantities of molten steel were produced, which means that the steel had been heated up to several thousand degrees. And witnesses during the cleanup reported that sometimes when a piece of steel was lifted out of the rubble, it was dripping molten metal. Sixth, according to many firefighters, medical workers, journalists, and World Trade Center employees, many explosions went off both before and during the collapses. For example, Fire Captain Dennis Tardil, speaking of the South Tower, said, "I hear an explosion and I look up. It is as if the building is being imploded from the top floor down, one after another, boom, boom, boom." Firefighter Richard Minasinski said, "It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings, it seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." Thanks to the release in August of 2005 of the oral histories recorded by the Fire Department of New York shortly after 9/11, dozens of testimony of this type are now available. A seventh feature of controlled implosions is the production of large quantities of dust. In the case of the Twin Towers, virtually everything except the steel, all the concrete, the desks, the computers, was pulverized into very tiny dust particles. The official story cannot explain one, let alone all seven, of these features, at least, as Hoffman and Jones point out, without violating several basic laws of physics. But the controlled demolition theory easily explains all these features. These findings are inconsistent with the idea that Al-Qaeda terrorists were responsible. Foreign terrorists could not have gotten access to those buildings for all the hours it would have taken to plant the explosives. Also, Al-Qaeda terrorists probably would not have had the courtesy to make sure that the buildings came straight down rather than toppling over. Terrorists working for the Bush-Cheney administration, by contrast, could have gotten such access. Given, you're ahead of me here. They could have gotten such access, especially given the fact that Marvin Bush and Wirt Walker III, the president's brother and cousin respectively, were principals of the company in charge of security for the World Trade Center. Another relevant fact is that the evidence was destroyed. An examination of the building's steel beams and columns could have shown whether explosives had been used to slice them. But virtually all of the steel was removed before it could be properly investigated, then put on ships to Asia to be melted down. It is usually a federal offense to remove anything from a crime scene, even a matchbook. But here the removal of over 100 tons of steel, the biggest destruction of evidence in history, was carried out under the supervision of federal officials. Evidence was also apparently planted. The passport of one of the hijackers on Flight 11 was allegedly found in the rubble. Having survived the fiery inferno, I'm not making this up. This passport had survived not only the fiery inferno caused by the airplane, but also whatever caused everything else in these buildings to be pulverized into tiny dust. The magic passport. To sum up, the idea that U.S. officials have given a satisfactory or even close to satisfactory explanation of the collapse of the World Trade Center is a myth. And these officials have implicitly admitted this by refusing to engage in rational debate about it. Michael Newman, a spokesman for NIST, reportedly said during a recent interview that none of the NIST scientists would participate in any public debate with scientists who reject their report. When Newman was asked why NIST would avoid public debate if it had confidence in its report, he replied, "Because there is no winning in such debates." In any case, I come now to the final myth, which is myth number 9. There is no doubt that Flight 77, under the control of Al-Qaeda hijacker Hani Hanyur, struck the Pentagon. There are, in fact, many reasons to doubt this claim. We have, in the first place, reasons to doubt that the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was under the control of Hani Hanjour. For one thing, the aircraft, before striking the Pentagon, reportedly executed a 270-degree downward spiral, and yet Hani Hanjour was known as a terrible pilot who could not safely fly even a small plane. Russ Wittenberg, who flew large commercial airliners for 35 years after serving in Vietnam as a fighter pilot, says that it would have been totally impossible for an amateur who couldn't even fly a Cessna to maneuver the jetliner in such a highly professional manner. A second major problem with the official story. There are reasons to believe that the Pentagon was struck only because officials at the Pentagon wanted it to be struck. For one thing, Flight 77 allegedly, after making a U-turn in the Midwest, flew back to Washington undetected for 40 minutes. And yet the U.S. military, which by then clearly would have known that hijacked airliners were being used as weapons, has the best radar systems in the world, one of which, it brags, does not miss anything occurring in North American airspace. The idea that a large airliner could have slipped through is absurd. Also, the Pentagon is surely the best defended building on the planet. It is not only within the P-56A restricted airspace that extends 17 miles in all directions from the Washington Monument, but also within the P-56B airspace, the 3-mile ultra-restricted zone above the White House, the Capitol, and the Pentagon. The Pentagon is only a few miles from Andrews Air Force Base, which has at least 3 squadrons with fighter jets on alert at all times. The claim by the 9/11 Commission report that no fighters were on alert the morning of 9/11 is wholly implausible, as I have explained in my book on this subject. The Pentagon, moreover, is reportedly protected by batteries of surface-to-air missiles. So if any aircraft without a U.S. military's transponder were to enter the Pentagon's airspace, it would be shot down. So even if the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was Flight 77, it could have succeeded only because officials in the Pentagon turned off their missiles, as well as ordering the fighters from Andrews to stand down. A third major problem with the official story is that there is considerable evidence it could not have been Flight 77 because it was not a Boeing 757. For one thing, the strike on the Pentagon, unlike the strikes on the Twin Towers, did not create a detectable seismic signal. Also, according to several witnesses and many people who have studied the available photographs, both the damage and the debris were inconsistent with a strike by a large airliner. That issue, however, is too complex to discuss here, as is the issue of what should be inferred from conflicting eyewitness testimony. Deferring those topics to another time, I will conclude by pointing out that the suspicion that the Pentagon was not struck by a 757, as the government claims, is supported by the fact that evidence was destroyed. Shortly after the strike, government agents picked up debris and carried it off. Shortly thereafter, the entire lawn was covered with dirt and gravel, so that any remaining forensic evidence was literally covered up. Also, the videos from security cameras on the nearby Citgo gas station and Sheraton Hotel, which would show what really hit the Pentagon, were immediately confiscated by agents of the FBI, and the Department of Justice has to this day refused to release them. If these videos would prove that the Pentagon was really hit by a 757, most of us would assume the government would release them. To conclude, it would seem for many reasons that the official story of 9/11, which has served as a religious myth in the intervening years, is a myth in the pejorative sense of a story that does not correspond with reality. One sign of that a story is a myth in this sense, I have pointed out, is that it cannot be rationally defended. The official story has never been publicly defended by any member of NIST or of the 9/11 Commission or of the Bush administration. After Charlie Sheen had made public his skepticism about the official story, CNN's Showbiz Tonight wanted to have a debate about the points he had raised between a representative of the government and a representative of 911truth.org. But the producers reportedly could find no member of the government willing to appear on the show. And this unwillingness of the government to appear on an entertainment show to answer questions raised by an actor, we would seem to have the clearest possible sign that the government's story is myth, not reality. If so, we must demand that the government immediately cease implementing the policies that have been warranted by the official account of 9/11. When charges were brought recently against members of Duke University's lacrosse team, the president of the university immediately canceled all future games until the truth of the charges could be decided. But surely, as serious as the charges against some members of this team are, the charges against the official story of 9/11 are far more serious. For this story, serving as a national religious myth, has been used to justify two wars, which have cost many tens of thousands of deaths, to start a more general war on radical Islam, in which Muslims around the world are now considered guilty until proven innocent, to annul and violate civil rights, and to increase our military spending, which was already greater than all the spending of the rest of the world together, and yet now we've increased it by several more billions of dollars, much of this being used to put weapons in space. Congress needs to put the implementation of these policies on hold until there is a truly independent investigation carried out by qualified individuals who are not members of the very circles that, if 9/11 truly was a false flag operation, planned it, carried it out, and then covered it up. Thank you very much for your attention.
That was David Ray Griffin. He spoke to an overflow audience on March 30th, 2006, in Oakland, California. David Ray Griffin is the author of The New Pearl Harbor and The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. This was part two of a one-hour lecture entitled 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org for more information. That's TUCradio.org. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.